Because I am, let's be clear, a big dork, there is nothing I get more excited about than Jobs Day, when the Labor Department releases its monthly data about who's gotten jobs, who's in the labor force, and who's not. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. On Friday, we got the last jobs report of the Obama economy. The numbers look decent. 227,000 jobs added in January, unemployment rate up a tick to 4.8%, but it's for a good reason. More Americans are entering the workforce. Best thing in this report? A higher percentage of people are now in the labor force. What all this means is that President Trump has a pretty healthy labor market to work with. Growth could be faster and people could certainly be paid more, but this is the backdrop for his policies. On this show, we'll talk about them, especially trade, the environment, and education. As always, we will get to some things now, leave others for future shows. What do you want us to explain? Visit Marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're going to start the show with our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. And ask our guests to analyze topics in the news. Here to join me this week are Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer and Joe Weisenthal, host of Bloomberg TV's What'd You Miss? Welcome to you both.
Hey, Lizzie. Thank you.
I want to start, Nancy, with your long, which knits into both policy and global geopolitics. Lay it out for us.
Lizzie, I think Canada is going to greatly benefit from the travel ban that President Trump has instituted against citizens of seven mostly Muslim countries. You may remember on Election Day, Canada's immigration website crashed, and some people are being encouraged to move to Canada, specifically tech folks. Canada's tech community actually has written a petition and sent a petition to the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, asking him to, quote, institute an immediate and targeted visa, providing those currently displaced by the U.S. executive order with temporary residency in Canada.
Do we think this is the kind of thing where, look, obviously this often comes up in political discussions, but you seem to think, based on your reporting, that there is real oomph behind this?
I will say there's a lot of interest at this point. Now, whether people actually will pick up stakes and move to Canada is another question. I mean, would they be able to, for example, make as much money in Canada as they could in the U.S.?
I think this is a great call for multiple reasons. I mean, obviously, the travel opportunities are clear, but in countries with a lot of English speakers have big global business advantages, given how important English is. Countries with stable rule of law, stable politics, that's, again, a big advantage. And so you look around the world for countries that seem to have it together, and Canada looks to be a shockingly stable country right now. So you could see lots of reasons why people and capital might start flowing there in greater levels.
Well, Canadian immigration policy actually gives extra points to people who have skills that Canada needs, like tech folks.
Joe, your short kind of fits in here because you are also looking at policy and policy affected by the Trump administration.
Yeah, so one of the things that people have tried to get enthusiastic about with this new administration is the idea that we're going to see this new era of fiscal stimulus. But I'm skeptical. I think what we're learning and what we could have already guessed really by listening and watching Trump is that this is a secondary issue for him. What he really cares about is the trade, immigration, and security stuff, and that anything that really involves legislative action is going to come later. If anything needed Democratic participation, I think that's going to be much harder to come by given the antipathy towards Trump on the left and the effect that will have on discouraging any Democratic politicians from cooperating with him. So I think, A, not only is this not really as much of a priority as some people might have hoped, I think it'll be a much harder haul getting anything through Congress if and when some sort of stimulus plan does come to the table.
And Joe, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, look, you've got a lot of Democrats in Congress who are now facing a possible primary challenge from the left. and being encouraged not to cooperate with Republicans on anything, and strongly encouraged. And people are even holding demonstrations in front of Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's apartment in New York.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. I think at one point early on after the election, some Democratic senators talked about things like, well, we'll work with Trump on areas where there's common ground. But you have not been hearing much of that kind of talk lately.
What sort of effect would losing the political will for a large fiscal stimulus, which is, in fact, what infrastructure spending is, what effect could that have rippling out? Because after all, one of the things that was sort of coupled with this, well, we'll do infrastructure spending campaign pledge was that there would be jobs to go along with it and that those would, you know, be in lots of different parts of the country, not just in places that voted for President Trump.
One of the important things to think about is that we're very close to levels that economists think is at full employment. And so arguably, from a cyclical perspective, this isn't the ideal time to do fiscal stimulus. But if you look at Trump's goals specifically, he obviously has goals that aren't just cyclical but structural, wanting to increase Rust Belt jobs, manufacturing jobs, parts of the country that haven't thrived as well. And so if there is legislative gridlock, if it does become difficult to pass laws, then that structural change that Trump hopes to make that would cement his legacy as a sort of great savior for the parts of the country that haven't done as well, it'll be harder to come by for him.
You know, it's interesting. I'm talking to you all from Georgia, and I've spent the past few days in a manufacturing area that makes carpet. Carpet, as you can imagine, is really tied to housing. And they have been struggling over the past few years, and this is their big economic push, is to try to recession-proof their industry, to make it bigger, to make it broader, to make it less dependent on one sector so that when inevitably the housing market dips again, they can still weather that without the kind of crisis that they saw then. And now the factories are employing lots of people. One I was at this week just hired 11 people the day before I walked in their door. So,
wow.
You know, sometimes that gets lost in the debate when we are talking about policy on a larger level. We forget, you know, the companies and the people that this affects.
But, you know, there's another impact if this fiscal stimulus doesn't come to pass, which is, hey, the stock market, right? I mean, one of the factors behind the stock market rally has been an anticipation of this infrastructure spending and how that could stimulate the economy. And if it doesn't happen, that could hurt the market and the psychology that's been behind this bull market.
Nancy, I want to shift to your short because it also looks at policy.
You know, it looks to me like Democrats are going to be much less likely to go along with changes to the financial reform law known as the Dodd-Frank law, which was passed after the financial crisis to, among other things, stabilize large financial institutions and make sure they don't fail again. I don't think that we're going to see much dismantling of Dodd-Frank, and here's why. First, the Federal Reserve is in charge of implementing a lot of the Dodd-Frank regulations, and it is still under the control of Fed Chair Janet Yellen. She's there for about another year. Plus, Donald Trump's nominees to head the various federal agencies, the other agencies that will be implementing Dodd-Frank, they won't be in office, you know, maybe for a year.
Joe, let's move to your long. What are you long?
I am long email. The people,
really?
Yeah, I really am. People have attacked email every few years. They talk about how email is dead. Email may have cost Hillary Clinton the election. So there's all kinds of reasons to hate email. But I'm having more good conversations on email than I have had in a long time with friends and colleagues and other stuff. And the reason is twofold. One, there's a lot of stuff to talk about that doesn't lend itself to short form things. You know, there's just a lot of big ideas to chew over. And we all know how miserable most social platforms are getting for various reasons, whether it's all the abuse on Twitter or all the nonsense you see. And so email is just great. It's quiet. You can go in depth. You can really have a real conversation with someone. And I think more and more people are going to come back to it. It's been proclaimed dead all these times, but I don't think it's going anywhere. And I think it's even going to gather steam.
If it's not dead yet, I want to kill it. I hate it. I'm emailing less and I'm texting more. I'm tweeting more. I hope you're wrong. I'll put it that way.
One thing I want to interject in this conversation, though, is that email, as many, many people have learned, is a permanent record. And if you email from your work account, let's say, you know, it belongs to the corporation where you work. I am curious to see how that plays out, in the federal government, how that plays out in different companies, and how that plays out as I think more people have become a bit more savvy about technology and technology privacy.
Well, I was going to say there are some alternatives to email. We use something called Slack, which is a kind of an instant messaging service that is just within a particular company. And I love it. It's fast. It's more efficient than email. And people tend to respond more to Slack than to email.
On the privacy thing, I mean, I do kind of worry that one day it'll all be hacked and then all these thoughts that I wanted to share privately, they might be all out there. So that would be really unfortunate.
You might have to actually go out and have coffee with somebody, Joe.
No, that sounds good, too, to be honest. I just don't have the time.
Nancy Marshall-Genzer from Marketplace, Joe Weisenthal from Bloomberg. Thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
After we recorded this segment, President Trump signed a directive aimed at changing Dodd-Frank and what's known as the fiduciary rule for financial advisors. It's the beginning of a long process, and everything Nancy talked about will be a major factor in all of this. We'll continue to keep reporting on it in the coming months.
One place where economic policy, specifically trade policy, meets real life is in the cars we drive and how they're made. Supply chains and factories in Mexico are a big part of that. And this week, major automakers and the companies that make their parts met in Mexico City to talk about their industry and try to figure out what trade policy under the Trump administration means for them. Natalie Kitoreff reports on the economy for the LA Times, and we talked to her from the conference. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about who is at this conference, because it's not just Mexican supply chains, but it's also the people they supply to. So who's there?
Right. So you have the big three automakers. There's Ford, GM, Fiat Chrysler, all of the Europeans as well, the Japanese car makers. I mean, you know, Mexico has become a powerhouse in car making, not just because of low labor costs, but because they've developed this very strong network of basically folks at this conference. So, you know, you have the car makers and then you have the auto parts suppliers and the railroads that take them across the border. So it's a group of people that have enjoyed unbridled success for the last several years. You know, what will happen as Trump sort of moves to potentially renegotiate NAFTA or institute some border adjustment tax potentially remains to be seen.
What kind of conversations are they having about NAFTA or about this potential tax on imports?
Right. So, you know, there is a lot of speculation without much real information behind it about what's going to happen. I mean, ending NAFTA altogether would be a huge blow for the car makers. Trump's press secretary floated the idea of a 20% tax on Mexican imports and then walked that back. But that, they say, would really affect consumers. And the consumers, they say, are in the United States. And so, I mean, what they don't, you know, add is that that would probably also affect their sales, right? I mean, if people are priced out of buying basic kind of compact cars, which is generally what's made here, although there are also pickups here, that will hit their bottom line too. That'll hit their profits. So a lot of speculation. There was someone at the conference this week who, his name's Al Zapanta. He is in consideration to be the U.S. ambassador to Mexico. And he struck a really positive note. He has met with Trump, he says, and, you know, his sense is that Trump is a negotiator. and that he likes to go into meetings and feel as if he's making a deal, and that the 20% figure is, you know, the opening salvo in what will be a long kind of negotiation process that is sort of already beginning. The other executives weren't so sure if they should follow his lead. So again, like with everything these days, no one really knows how to respond.
A lot of the conversations around this issue have focused on jobs in Mexico and things that are shipped out of Mexico. I want to flip that around for a second. Are there American jobs on the line if we see some of these tax policies or some more sort of protectionist policies in general instituted?
Yeah, there are a lot of U.S. jobs that are intricately tied to trade with Mexico, to the cars that flow across the border. And, you know, we're not just talking about sales jobs in the U.S. Or, you know, parts making jobs. We're talking about railroad jobs, trucking jobs, you know, a lot of blue collar kind of employment here that is really, you know, we're just talking about bringing the actual product over. There are also, though, manufacturing jobs in the United States that are tied to the work that's done in Mexico. And that's because, you know, Mexican cars are not actually entirely Mexican. Of the cars that we imported from Mexico in 2015, 40% of the contents were made by Americans. And so you can imagine, I mean, stanching the flow of cars that contain 40% American parts across the border would most certainly affect American jobs.
You cover the economy. You focus a lot on manufacturing. What do you think that the general American audience doesn't see, doesn't hear about these debates that you're able to see from this moment being in Mexico City?
I think there's two things. I mean, the first thing I would say is the point about the relationship, the ties that we have. You know, cars don't get made in one factory in Michigan anymore. The supply chain globally is advanced to the point where all of the kind of advanced kind of economies have other partners that are perhaps less advanced. We're talking about, I mean, places like Japan and Germany, they're all relying on countries that are less advanced that can produce some part of the product that they also make there. And so this is happening across the globe. I mean, here at this conference, for example, some of the automakers were saying, if the Americans are worried about kind of Mexicans, quote unquote, taking their jobs, then, you know, the Germans should be up in arms. The Japanese should be up in arms. I mean, this is happening everywhere. Like, the way that these supply chains work is that a car can cross the border between the U.S. and Mexico as it's being made 5, 6, I heard 9 times. That means that, you know, the way we work and we build things now is that our jobs depend on their jobs. And the second thing I would say is automation, which, you know, automation is happening across the globe. This isn't like we're exporting 1950s America to Mexico. We are exporting 2017 American manufacturing to Mexico. And yes, people are being lifted into the middle class. And yes, there are manual labor jobs, and it is much cheaper to do in Mexico. And Americans in the Rust Belt, you know, have every right to be concerned and worried about what that means. But Mexicans are also getting totally automated factories. So the factory of today is not creating as many jobs in Mexico as it did in the U.S. in 1950.
Natalie Kitroeff, who covers economics for the LA Times, who is speaking to me from Mexico City. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Let's stay with trade in Mexico. American companies with overseas operations are trying to balance a lot right now. Some are under pressure from activists and customers to take a stand on the Trump administration's travel ban. Others are being pushed to create jobs in the U.S. or bring them back here. Our colleague Kimberly Adams has been reporting from Mexico, whose largest trading partner is the U.S., on what all of this means to people there.
President Trump has been clear. He says he will bring back industrial and manufacturing jobs from Mexico, and he'll be happy to call out companies like Carrier and Ford to prevent them from expanding south of the border. Salvador Contreras teaches economics at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. He says many companies are just trying to conduct business as usual.
What I suspect is going to happen is they're going to continue to operate steady as we go while they get better clarification.
But some Mexicans who work the assembly lines at these factories, called maquiladoras, are worried about Trump's plans. Viviana Valenzuela makes plastic dishes in Nogales, Mexico, that are also exported to the U.S.
Among the employees, we talk and make comments, and it's logical. We're all bothered by what he's doing and what he wants to do to the Mexicans.
Trump promises to renegotiate trade deals like NAFTA to get better deals for American workers and has indicated he's open to taxing goods coming from Mexico to help pay for a border wall. Here's Press Secretary Sean Spicer talking with reporters on a recent flight.
If you think about what a border tax on imports from countries like Mexico that we have a huge trade deficit does, that's really going to provide the funding.
That's one idea the Trump administration is floating. It's unlikely, though, American companies will pack up shop and leave Mexico anytime soon.
You can't just, you know, turn off the lights and walk away.
That's Professor Contreras at the University of Texas again.
I mean, these are, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars investments in infrastructure and facilities and training people to produce the goods and services that they produce.
Which is why another factory worker in Nogales, Jose Antunes, isn't worried about his job at a tampon factory.
A majority of the businesses that come from the United States or other countries, what they look for is stability and ways to save money. And in this aspect, I think we're fine.
Not to mention that pay at these factories is still a fraction of what it is in the U.S. And the Mexican peso hasn't been doing so well against the dollar since Trump's election. That could make it even cheaper for American companies to stay put, even with a tax. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
And now to how trade affects what we wear. Nearly all clothing sold in the United States is imported from other countries. Fibers from one country turns into fabric in another. You get the picture. We mentioned the idea of import tariffs in our conversation with Natalie Kitroeff. So what would those taxes or even renegotiated trade deals mean for the apparel industry? Marketplace's Marielle Segarra has that story.
Azam Khawaja is standing behind the cash register at AK Fabrics, his wholesale fabric store in New York City's Garment District. Brightly colored textiles, many of them made overseas in countries like China and Mexico, hang from racks lining the walls. Khawaja says tariffs on imports would hurt his business.
The price is going to go up, and we have to pass it to consumers, and a lot of people, they're not happy about it.
Those consumers are designers and clothing makers like Karen Fleisch, who's standing outside the store where she's been shopping for 30 years. She says she'll be forced to pass those costs on to her customers.
I got overhead and I got to eat.
She worries some customers won't be willing to pay the higher prices.
I used to sell a dress to somebody and it used to cost them maybe $500. Now it's going to cost them $800.
It's not just designer dresses that would cost more under the tariff plan. Almost all of the everyday clothes you'd buy at a retailer, jeans, t-shirts, underwear, are made overseas. Gianluca Clementi is a professor at New York University's Stern School of Business.
Those are going to have a higher price, and that is going to put a dent on the wallet of American consumers and also on the bottom line of American companies.
Trump says the point of renegotiating U.S. trade deals is to bring manufacturing jobs back to the United States. Clementi says for the apparel industry, tariffs won't accomplish that, in part because overseas labor will still be cheaper.
A 20% tariff wouldn't even get close to close the gap.
Tasha Lewis, who teaches fashion design management at Cornell, says the United States also wouldn't be able to scale up its production to meet demand.
We don't have a lot of infrastructure currently that could handle the volume of what we might want to sell in retail stores.
Not the kind of news consumers or retailers want to hear just a few weeks ahead of the big spring shopping season. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
This coming week, the Senate is expected to vote on the nomination of Betsy DeVos to lead the Department of Education. Her confirmation process has been among the most contentious for this new Trump administration. Republican Senator Lamar Alexander, who chairs the Education Committee, called her, quote, the most questioned nominee for Education Secretary in history. Joining me now to talk about this controversy is Amy Scott. She's Marketplace's senior education correspondent, speaking from WYPR in Baltimore. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Lizzie.
So for the people who haven't been following this debate closely, tell us who Betsy DeVos is and why her nomination has been so controversial.
Yeah, so she comes from a very wealthy family in Michigan. Her husband's father is a co-founder of Amway, the multi-level marketing company. Her father made his fortune in the auto parts business. Her brother, Eric Prince, founded the private military company Blackwater. And her family has given millions of dollars to conservative Christian causes. She's a big believer in school choice, the idea that every family, regardless of income, should be able to send their kids to the school of their choice, whether it's public, private, or religious. And that's one of the big reasons that she's controversial. She's a big believer in charter schools and vouchers that allow kids to use public money to attend those schools. Critics are also concerned about her lack of experience. She's a longtime advocate for kids and for school choice, but she's never worked as a teacher or a school administrator. Her fans say that's actually an asset, that she comes from outside the system. But in her confirmation hearing, she also seemed unfamiliar with some aspects of federal law and even unwilling to commit to enforcing some aspects of the law and some regulations.
If she is confirmed, what do we know about what she wants to do and plans to do?
Not all that much. She hasn't given interviews during this confirmation process, and her responses during the confirmation hearing were often pretty vague. You know, I'll have to review that, or I look forward to working with you on that. There weren't a whole lot of specifics. But during the campaign, President Trump proposed a $20 billion school choice program that would give grants to states to fund voucher programs for low-income kids. That's likely to be on the agenda. She also indicated that she would review some federal regulations, like gainful employment regulations aimed at for-profit colleges, which are designed to make sure graduates earn enough to afford their loans. As in the Trump administration generally, we're likely to see some efforts to reduce regulations. And Congress is already moving to undo some of those from the Obama administration as well.
How much power does the education secretary have? After all, it's not just K through 12, it's also higher ed.
Yeah, in some ways, not that much, actually. I mean, only 10% of K-12 education funding comes from the federal government. Most of it is state and local. So she would only have so much power to influence the schools that take that money. As you mentioned, she will also oversee the multi-billion dollar federal student loan program associated with higher education. But she'll have less power than previous education secretaries because Congress passed a law at the end of 2015, the Every Student Succeeds Act, which limits how much she can impose on schools. She can't, say, impose certain learning standards or accountability systems. And her defenders have said she's not going to force policy on states, but really leave a lot to them and then, you know, try to lead from the bully pulpit to influence policy.
Let's say she survives this confirmation vote. This has been a polarizing period of time. How could that impact her ability to be effective?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly could strain her relationships with Democrats in Congress and the two Republicans who've said they'll vote against her, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, as well as with other education groups who have opposed her nomination, particularly the teachers' unions. She may not get the typical sort of honeymoon period that new cabinet secretaries get, and I think she'll have to work to repair some of those relationships when she starts out.
Amy Scott, Marketplace's senior education correspondent, speaking to me from WYPR in Baltimore. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
It's time for the Marketplace quiz. That's when we ask people in the spotlight questions about work and money. And this week, we are turning the spotlight on ourselves with a special Marketplace duo. Kai Rizdahl and Molly Wood. Go for it, guys.
Hey, everybody. I'm Kai.
And I am Molly. And we are we're the hosts of Make Me Smart, the brand new podcast.
Other days, it would be a different answer. But today, it's Make Me Smart.
I think I know the answer to this. But in a next life, or maybe later in this one, what would your career be?
Oh, I would be a helicopter pilot in the Grand Canyon.
I did not know the answer to that. Nope. I thought I did, but I didn't.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like for tourists?
Yeah.
Tell me more. Why is this your dream?
Because why wouldn't it be cool to fly a helicopter over, through, and around the Grand Canyon? I mean, the problem is, right, airspace regulations being what they are, you can't actually fly a helicopter through the Grand Canyon. You got to be, like, over it and all this jazz, but, you know, that'd be cool.
Oh, that's why it has to be the next life when those regulations are all gone.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
This one.
My fantasy life. What is something you bought that you now regret buying?
Oh, my goodness. I bought that I now regret buying. I do regret. No, I don't, though, because in the end, I gave money to my school. I will tell you a story about a thing that I regretted buying that turned out to be great,
okay,
which is that very shortly after I graduated from college, I had my first big girl job and went into a shoe store, and they had this pair of Italian leather boots. Beautiful, like nubuck brown. I mean, yeah, they just looked like chocolate gorgeousness. And I spent $200 on them. And for context, my rent was $325. Yeah. So, like, it was not a good idea. And I took them home and I was like, this is not a good idea. This is really not a good idea. And I tried to take them back to the store and she was like, honey, nobody returns $200 leather boots after you've worn them. And
wore them?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I was stuck with them. But here's the thing. I had them for 20 years.
Oh, yeah. See, there you go.
Italian leather boots are no joke.
No.
And I've never actually... I answered the opposite question, but I've never loved a regret purchase more. Kai?
Yes?
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows about? You poor darling.
Oh, man. There are so many ways to answer this question that would get me in so much trouble. So I got maybe 2.5. Number one is you can't always say what you think. Mm-hmm. You can't. It's tempting, but you can't. The other one, honestly, and this is going to be a big fat boo-hoo, you know, cry me a river question, but daily deadline journalism can be grinding sometimes. And sometimes that's just no fun. When you see people like at Marketplace, we go on the air at 2:00 in LA, and you see people going out at 12:15 to have lunch, and you're like, no, man, I don't actually get a lunch hour. So that's kind of a drag. But honestly, there's nothing I don't like about my job. Full stop.
Although I remember doing a daily podcast and I would see those people standing in the halls talking and I was like, what the hell is wrong with you?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Don't you have somewhere to be?
Paycheck today, pal, or what? Yeah. What was your very first job?
I think the first job I actually ever got paid for was at a grocery store.
I think
I was a grocery store checker and I loved bagging the bags.
Really?
It was like Tetris. Really? I still love it. I'm still that lady at Trader Joe's.
Somehow
like,
that doesn't
I'll
surprise
bag
me
it.
At all. Doesn't surprise me at all.
What is your most prized possession?
I mean, a younger me would have said my car, but an older me drives a minivan, and I just can't and I just can't go there.
Ouch.
I have a picture of my dad, which is him not too terribly long before he died. They had retired to Florida, and Dad was working in a in a, I guess he was working in a hospital. He was like a candy striper, except not really a candy striper because he was a 75-year-old man. And it's just him looking straight at the camera. And it's just, it's a nice little thing that I have. And I guess that's probably up there on the list. I mean, I'm not a possessions kind of guy, but that's up there.
That's a good one.
Mollywood, here you go. What advice do you wish somebody had given you before you or as you were starting your career?
I wish that someone had said, you don't have to give everything to the company that you work for.
Hmm.
You can be ambitious and you can do good work and you can try really, really hard, but you don't marry them. They don't. It's a company that and it doesn't love you back.
You know, that is so interesting because my answer to that question is you got to play the hand you're dealt. And if that means, going balls out, then that means going balls out. But you have to remember that my first two careers were sort of non-voluntary. Well, they were voluntary, but you didn't have much choice once you were there, right? Because I spent 8 years in the military and then four years in the State Department, right? And so the answer was when the bell rings, you pick up the damn phone. You know?
That, which is so fascinating because, I apparently evolved in the total opposite direction,
right.
Which was sometimes the bell will ring and you'll say, you know what? No, this is my life and I'm going to live it.
Yeah. Huh.
And that's why I changed my mind about the Air Force Academy early.
There you go. And you know what? You had a better time in those 8 years because you're like, no, I'm not doing this.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Maybe.
There you go. That's the Marketplace Quiz.
You can listen to Make Me Smart on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Two weeks into the new administration, a lot is already changing. We've been talking about trade and tariffs, but another important issue is the environment. The thing is, the government collects a lot of the information that researchers and the world at large use to study the environment and issues like climate change. So what could shifting policies mean? We have Zoe Schlanger, environment reporter at Quartz, to talk to us about this. Welcome back.
Good to be here, Lizzie.
I want you to tell me a little bit about what scientific data the federal government collects and where it goes, kind of where it is stored.
This is a fascinating thing. The federal government collects so much data on the environment and climate change that many people in the U.S. don't even realize. NOAA, the office that studies the ocean, collects data from all over the country, basically gives us our weather data that we use every day. But they also collect data from all over the world. Many other agencies like the U.S.'s NOAA agency are routing their data both to their agencies and to ours. So basically, the U.S. is a repository for the most climate data of anywhere in the world.
When we think about how that is used to make policy, can you tell me a little bit about what we know so far about how that is changing under the new administration, recognizing that it's still early days?
Yes, there's a lot we still don't know. Something I think we'll probably be seeing change quite a bit is how much hand Congress has in those science-based rules. Something called the Congressional Review Act is most likely to become very prominent. It's only really been used successfully once before, so we don't really know if it's going to work from a legal standpoint, but it means that Congress will be able to vote up or down on agencies' decisions to create regulations, which has never really happened before.
The new administration sent what it has called beachhead teams into a couple of different agencies, and notably ones that deal with science and with climate change. At the same time, Wilbur Ross has said that, you know, science will be able to act on its own. NOAA falls under the umbrella of the Commerce Department. Is it going to be possible for Americans to look at what data is out there and know whether it comes straight from science or whether there is politics involved?
This is a major question right now that even people who work at some of these agencies are not sure about anymore. One thing we know is that some of the people appointed to various transition teams, like, for example, NOAA, these transition teams have been staffed with people with clear political agendas. Some of them are genuine climate change deniers who have spent careers trying to disprove things that are considered accepted science on the matter of climate change. So that is of concern. But then you have people like Wilbur Ross, who has said in his confirmation hearing that he promises to protect the data that's available online and promote scientific research, saying that America is known for its amazing scientific research and he won't try to change that.
You also wrote about a move by some researchers to move this data elsewhere and take it essentially outside of the U.S. because they were afraid of, you know, this political debate.
Yeah, there's frankly a really incredible movement going on underground in a sort of way to do that. There's been about six or seven events where programmers and scientists and librarians and archivists are all getting together in a room and spending all day finding ways to download government data, especially data around climate change or environmental science, and try and re-upload it to a secondary repository. They're kind of building a proxy site for government data that they say will safeguard it through this administration.
Often when you talk to businesses, and I have been in an area with a lot of big companies, companies that make carpet, for example, they are already working with a larger template in mind, one that looks at multinational agreements, one that looks at abiding by, say, rules in Germany if they move their products there or if they make products there. How does this sort of start to play into questions about how the new administration makes environmental policy? Do you see tension between, say, businesses, and mostly I'm talking about multinational companies, and sort of the environmental policy that we have seen outlined thus far by the Trump administration?
This is a really important point. I think a lot of people are starting to think about this as a ray of hope from an environmental perspective or a climate change perspective, that many businesses that operate in countries with more progressive, scientifically progressive approaches to things like emissions or toxic standards or things like that are already abiding by rules that are adhering more to the science available. It's also something we have to think about with some of these EPA rules. Scott Pruitt, who may be leading the EPA, is a major opponent of some of the basic air toxic rules from the Obama administration. But it doesn't seem that he's going to be able to really roll much of that back, because many of these major power plants, for example, have already spent thousands and thousands of dollars to comply with Obama's rules. So there may be movements in written regulations that will have a diminished effect based on how they're actually carried out.
Zoe Schlanger, environment reporter at Quartz, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Let's take a slightly wider environmental look now. Air pollution is an increasing problem in cities around the world. And data from the European Union suggests it causes almost as many early deaths as smoking. And one of the biggest single contributors, diesel car emissions. The BBC's Alex Ritson reports.
Cycling through London streets is a constant danger, weaving in and out of traffic. There's a lorry reversing towards me now. I'm going through a little slot between a bus and that lorry. But one of the biggest risks is actually not from the traffic, it's from the greasy, stinky air. I'm going to see the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, to find out what he's planning to do about it.
The air we all breathe.
I arrived to find the mayor speaking to a group of children about air quality.
Some of our fellow citizens. The previous mayor, he's a bad guy. He was doing nothing about it. I'm what I call the good guy.
I asked Mr. Khan why this mattered to him.
Over 9,000 Londoners die as a result of the poor quality air. There are children in some parts of London whose lungs are underdeveloped because of the poor quality air. We've had a UK Supreme Court finding and a High Court finding saying that our air is in breach of the Air Quality Directive. So the air in London is a killer, it makes you sick, and it's illegal. Look, I can either be the last generation who doesn't understand how bad the air is and fails to take action, clean it up, or I can be the first generation who takes action to clean up the air in London.
And his audience seemed to know a lot more about the issue than a lot of grown-ups.
If you breathe bad air, it could affect your lungs. If that happens, you could die.
So what's causing the problem here?
Vehicles and people like the vehicles that are running on diesel, they're causing lots of smoke.
Well, I'm quite worried because it could kill lots of people or they would get very sick.
Why do you think it's happening?
because all the pollution inside the cars is coming out when you drive in them.
I think we should all put a stop to pollution, and we should encourage everyone to stop driving cars.
How could you stop driving cars if school is far away? That would be, you'd have to drive a little, but you could stop a few blocks away.
What if you can just take a train?
Well, you should use electric cars are better, but they're more expensive. So people should, maybe the mayor should reduce the prices of electric cars so that the air pollution isn't so bad.
You wanted to say something.
Yes, I think most of the pollution is being caused by diesel petrol. So some petrols are good for cars. They don't release a lot of pollution. But diesel is very bad petrol, so it releases most pollution.
The mayors of Paris, Madrid, Athens and Mexico City recently announced they'd be bringing in a complete ban on diesel cars by 2025. Sadiq Khan, Mayor of London, doesn't have the power to do that. But he does have other plans.
A large part of the poor quality air comes from emissions from cars. And so this year in October, we'll be introducing a T-charge for the cars which are the worst polluters. Basically, those cars registered before 2006. We're then going to, in 2019, introduce an ultra-low emission zone. Only if your car is very clean will you be able to come into central London. And that will hopefully lead to better quality air around schools, so when children play in the playground, they're not breathing in this noxious stuff.
But not everyone's completely convinced. Nick Molden runs the Emissions Analytics Testing Group. He says London's ultra-low emissions zone relies on Europe-wide laboratory test standards that take no account of what comes out of the exhaust pipe in the real world.
The new diesel cars are, on average, well over the limit. In fact, about five times the limit is the nitrogen oxides they're putting out. But interestingly, there are some cars which are really clean, meeting the limit, others which are 12, 15, 20 times over the limit, all to the same official standard.
And these are cars that would be able to get into the new ultra-low emission zone because their actual emissions are different to what they pump out in the lab.
They're certified to the current level, therefore they would get in. But their real-world emissions are hugely different.
So I'm back on my bike now, fighting my way along Whitehall, just right by 10 Downing Street. I'm off to meet the people who are responsible for a lot of this air pollution, the people that represent the auto industry.
My name is Mike Hawes. I'm the Chief Executive of Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders. What will happen as of September, if you want to put a diesel car on the market and as a manufacturer throughout Europe, you have to meet this test, which will be the most stringent in the world, whether it's petrol, whether it's diesel. This will require that the vehicle must meet a lower target than we've had in years gone by in a huge variety of circumstances, whether you're driving at 160 kilometres an hour, whether you're driving at 5 kilometres an hour, whether you're at 2,000 metres in altitude, whether you're at sea level, whether it's minus 7, whether it's plus 35. It will have to meet that continuously. Do that, and whatever the scenario, these vehicles will be much cleaner and help address the urban air quality problem.
And for his sake, I hope he's right, because the Mayor of London is giving kids impressive lessons in how to make their voices heard in the future.
That's Alex Ritson from our partners at the BBC. And that's our show for this week. A special thanks to WABE in Atlanta for being excellent hosts. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Eliza Mills, with help this week from Danielle Stevens. Dan Samatovich is our senior producer. Jake Gorski is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.